too brown, too unfortunate. Then again, I'd gotten this far. Why not me? I looked over at Gemma, and she had this sneaky smile on her face.
See you in London town, she said.
She then handed me my application, which she'd already filled out for me. Not long after, I got the news. I was going to the United Kingdom. Gemma and a few of my other friends got in too. The Westminster campus of Regent's University London, my college's partner school, could have been yanked off the set of Downton Abbey. Old brick buildings around a grassy quad, cobblestone walkways, sycamores displaying autumn's red golden leaves. Adrian, Gemma, and I shared a decked-out suite with a balcony overlooking a picturesque courtyard while Paula was in her own room on the second floor. If I had been underground in Boston, I became a friggin' MI6 agent in London. I'd only shared my story with Adrian. One night when I was being particularly difficult to deal with, she said, "What's your deal?" So I spilled the beans.
"Oh, it all makes sense now," she said.
"What?" I asked. She just hugged me and told me I was safe. From then on, I didn't tell another soul about my background. "Where do your parents live?" some people would ask me. "Oh, they passed away," I said. Other times, I claimed that my mother and father had returned to Colombia to run their own business. "They're retired," I explained. I had so many different tales going around that Adrian was like, "You'd better keep your lives straight. You're losing your shit out there. Pull yourself together, Captain!" Arr! The way I saw it, this time in London was my opportunity to become someone else. To take on an identity in a plot of my own creation. If I'd revealed my tragic past, others would have pitied me. And I was so over pity. What I wanted was to be normal. I now get it that normal is relative, and even the person who appears so together is dealing with something. Así es la vida. During my entire time away, I talked to Mommy and Papi only a few times. In one of those calls, Mommy dropped some news. "I'm moving to Madrid," she said. I gulped.
"Madrid? Why?"
"I need to start over somewhere new," she said, as if she'd read my mind.
Years ago, in the 70s, my mother's brother had relocated to Spain to pursue his dream as a bullfighter. Even though jobs were scarce in Madrid, there was still more opportunity than Colombia had to offer.
"That's nice, Mommy," I said.
Wow. I didn't have much to say because I was so stunned. Also, I was so immersed in college life that I really ignored the fact that my parents were still living their own lives without me.
"No time to be sad," I told myself. "You gotta keep it moving."
"Good, Mommy. That's great," I said.
I didn't ask whether she'd be there before I left the region. I was too focused on pretending I wasn't her daughter, acting as if the life we shared hadn't existed, and that she was retired and or deceased. Even with all this pretending, I still managed to fulfill my duties as a responsible college student. My time in London was amazing, an experience I thought a girl like me would never have. I loved my classes, and I was thriving in a foreign land where people had accents. On breaks and on weekends, I traveled with my gals all over Europe, seeing things I hadn't imagined in my wildest dreams. I was living on bread, tomato, and crisps, but my God, it was a dream. The worst thing I could have done would have been to deny myself the opportunity because of fear or feeling like I didn't deserve it. It was one of those times when I really saw the power of having a dream and making it come true no matter the obstacles. The only thing I would have changed would have been to have lived that dream as myself and not as someone else. I returned to the States, but not to Regis right away. I enjoyed my experience abroad so much that I decided to spend the spring semester in the field, this time at American University in Washington, D.C., another of my college's partner schools. Ahead of my program, I spent the holidays with Brian in Boston. When I told him about D.C., he wasn't too keen.
"Why can't you go next year?" he shouted.
You've already been away so long.
I don't want to go next year, I shot back. And why are you flipping out? I'll be in D.C., not Europe.
We can take the train to see each other.
The argument certainly clouded my decision and made D.C. a little gloomier than I'd hoped. In retrospect, I should have nipped that shit in the bud and kicked them to the curb. But alas, the heart wants what it doesn't need sometimes.
I realized this wasn't the healthiest of relationships, but fuck, it's not like I had anything else super important going on, right?
Despite Brian's objections, I set off for my program in the nation's capital. I'd chosen foreign policy as my concentration. At this point, I was thinking about a career as a diplomat.
Why aren't you doing American policy? Adrian asked me. She knew I preferred debating this country's social issues.
As it turns out, my friend was right. The topics we discussed in class, though important, put me to sleep. U.S.-China relations, free trade agreements, United Nations resolutions, snore.
College is a chance to explore, but even by the middle of my junior year, I was no closer to figuring out my path. I wanted to serve others and to do work that had meaning. That I knew. What I didn't know is how to end up there. I had no one saying, "Hey, Diane, what are you going to do with this degree?" I was just drifting and praying the wind would carry me in the right direction.
My time in D.C. was pure misery. A month into my coursework, my financial aid collapsed. I discovered, too late, that my federal student loans couldn't be transferred to cover my costs at American. In desperation, I applied for private loans with high interest rates. I put my signature on agreements I had no business signing, but it was the only way forward that I could see. Those loans didn't come through immediately. So in place of studying, I was agonizing over whether I'd be booted out on my behind. I got called into the financial aid office on several occasions. Things got so tense, in fact, that I considered quitting altogether and booking a one-way flight to Colombia. But I knew that wasn't the answer. I mean, you can't run away from your problems. College gave me a shot at a future. I fell into depression. I'm not referring to a little case of the blues. I'm talking about a dark, heavy fog that kept me in bed for days at a time. I skipped classes. I stopped socializing. My appetite disappeared and I dropped 20 pounds. From Boston, Adrian checked on me.
"Diane, what's up?" she'd call and ask. "I haven't heard from you. You okay?"
I put on a brave voice and reassured her I was fine so I can get her off the line. The pain for me was beyond emotional. It was physical. I literally felt as if I was about to burst. My whole body ached. I'd been low before, but never this low, which is why I decided the meds were contributing to my mood. So without consulting a doctor, I stopped taking the pills. And the impact on my grades was immediate and disastrous. In a month, I went from excelling to nearly flunking out. Things unraveled further from there. The combination of everything, my disastrous loan situation, my plummeting grades, my souring relationship, overwhelmed me. I had a lot riding on this grand plan to make it through school, land a job, and bring my parents back here. None of it was falling into place. I should go back to Regis, I kept thinking after I realized the financial hot mess I was in. Where did I go wrong? My life was a big unfinished project, one I feared I'd never complete. I was disappointed in my choices. How could a school year that began on such an amazing high in London end up in the ditch? When that attorney duped my father out of his life savings, Bobby wanted to give up. That is exactly what I wanted to do. I was so burdened and exhausted that I hardly had the will to carry on. At the close of the semester, I dragged myself back to Boston and moved in with Brian again. I knew the relationship wasn't the smartest choice, but it was all I knew. I had come to rely on him. Depression can take various forms, and mine showed up in new ways that summer and into the following fall. I love to party. and I went out a lot with the girls from work. I'd crawl home drunk at 3 a.m. and then awaken the following afternoon dizzy and dry-mouthed. I didn't give a shit about missing class. Several times, I got so wasted that I passed out and my friends had to lift me into a cab and escort me to the house. Even now, years later, there are periods of that time I cannot recall because I was blacked out. I pushed everyone away. "Please call me," Gabby pleaded on my voicemail. "Please tell me you're okay." Sabrina, Eva, Amelia, and my aunt and uncle in New Jersey all rang as well, but I wouldn't call back. Adrian once came to my apartment and banged on the door. "Hey, Diane," she yelled out. "Are you in there?" I ignored her. I had no desire whatsoever to discuss what was happening to me or to reveal the tightrope I was on. So I tuned out my loved ones. And the more I rejected their help, the more isolated I became. And the more I drank and socialized. I didn't simply want to take the edge off. I wanted to be numb. In most weeks, I couldn't have told you whether it was a Monday or a Thursday. Every day felt the same, like one I'd rather sleep through. It was wash, rinse, repeat. Depression, drunken revelry, fighting with Brian, shame about my behavior, and then always, always, another round of liquid anesthesia. Diane? My eyes fluttered open. Brian stood at my hospital bed, looking down over me. Around us was a blue curtain, one of those fabric partitions used to separate one patient from the next. My head throbbed. The room was blurry. I looked down to notice that my forearms were wrapped tightly in white bandages. A monitor at my left tracked my heartbeat. Beep, 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 beep. "What happened?" I muttered. "Where am I?" Brian pressed his lips together. You tried to hurt yourself again," he said. He nodded towards my arms. I peered at them and then back at him. "You know," he whispered, leaning in close to my ear, "you cut yourself." The cutting. The first time I hurt myself was in D.C. That morning I received the horrible news about my lungs, and by that evening I was inconsolable. I uncorked some Merlot, sat on the floor in the middle of my room, and drank a glass at a time until the bottle was empty. For the life of me, I could not understand what I was feeling. I was uncomfortable, almost to the point of wanting to get out of my skin. I was literally trying to pull myself out of myself. I rolled around, slapped myself, pulled my hair, and dug my nails into my skin. I was exhausted and panicked. I thought, do I just have to sit here and feel all of this shit? Why? I looked in the mirror and cried out for my mother. "Ma! Mama! Where are you? Please! Mama! Papa!" Like a child, I wrapped my arms around my knees and rocked my body back and forth, as if doing so would soothe my distress. It didn't, and in an instant I wish I could reverse. I grabbed the wine corkscrew from the table nearby, pointed its sharp tip into my arm, and ripped across my skin. As I saw the blood drip down from my arm, my eyes widened. I got up and raced for a towel. "What the hell is wrong with you?" I thought. I did eventually pull it together. After that episode, I promised myself I'd never do that again. It frightened me. And yet, it also brought a strange relief. For a brief moment, the sharp physical pain blunted all other anguish, a kind of temporary interruption to my despair. It also put me in control. At the time, I saw myself as powerless. Although cutting did not offer a solution to my problems, I used it as a way to calm myself down when I got out of control. With a slight turn of my hand, in the privacy of my home, I could decide how I wanted to feel. I was in charge. I was holding the weapon. My vow to myself didn't stick. As the sadness intensified, so did my urge to hurt myself. I tried to avoid it by writing letters to myself. I scribbled page after page about how lost I was. But my desire to release grew so intense that it overtook me. Those who've done this to themselves would probably describe that desire the same way I do. It's like suffocating. Hurting yourself is a way to breathe again. So stupid. At first, I would do only little cuts on my arms and thighs where the wounds weren't all that noticeable, since I usually used a sharp razor or a kitchen knife. I figured it wasn't a problem and almost liked the sensation and the secrecy of it. But after a while, I knew I was fucking losing it. I thought the feeling of wanting to do this crazy thing to myself would go away, but as time went on, I wasn't getting any better. Surprise! I had ended the semester poorly and left DC feeling quite unaccomplished, a fact made worse by my new nasty little habit. As time went on, if I was having an episode, I'd pick up anything that happened to be close. A bobby pin, a metal nail file, a paperclip. The less sharp the object, the nastier the scar. I was lost, and I was becoming a huge inconvenience to myself and those around me, especially poor Brian. I say poor Brian because no one deserves the kind of crazy I was exhibiting. These tantrums became more and more frequent and scary. I was exploding, and all of those years of being the good girl and being strong for everyone were going out the window. I couldn't hold it in anymore. I was beside myself. The curtain swung open. A nurse, a heavy-set woman with wiry silver curls and Coke bottle glasses, marched in with a clipboard. "May I have a minute alone with her?" she said to Brian. He nodded and stepped out. "You want to talk about this, hun?" she said. I didn't respond. She scanned my take-in sheet. She paused and looked intently into my face. "We've got social workers on staff here. I'd like to set you up with one. Would you like that?" "Yes, but please don't take me away," I said, sounding like a child. The trauma I'd lived through with my folks seeped out in so many ways. It was like I was stuck in time. "No one is going to take you away," she said, reopening the curtain. "Are your folks in the area?" "No," I answered. "Well," she told me, "I really do hope you can get some help. You need it." "Ha! Don't I know it, lady?" Maybe I needed someone to tell me that, to take notice of me and the pain I was feeling inside. Or maybe I wanted to be taken care of. Whatever the reason, she was right. I needed help and fast. The hospital released me that same evening. The drive home was quiet. "I'm worried about you," Brian finally said to break the silence. "We've got to figure this out. I want to help you, but I don't know how." It's funny how you can be sitting right next to someone and feel lonelier than you would be if you were alone. That's how I felt. The hospital stay scared me straight for a couple of months. But like alcohol or drugs, which I was doing a lot of, cutting can be addictive. On the rare occasion that I bothered to show up for class, I'd catch people looking at my arms and then quickly averting their gazes when I noticed they're gawking. Their facial expressions said it all. "What the hell is wrong with you?" I felt like a failure and a freak of nature. Others tried to throw me a life preserver, but in one instance, that seemed like a betrayal. Someone anonymously told the dean's office about my scars, and I got a call from the Regis Counseling Center. "Diane?" said the therapist when she finally got me on the line. "I need you to come in and see me." Fuck. A few days later, I shuffled through the office doors at 3 p.m. I'd just gotten out of bed after another night of partying. My olive skin had grown pale, my face was gaunt, my eyes were bloodshot. I was skin and bones and wearing a turtleneck in 75-degree weather. The counselor met me in the waiting room. She was a middle-aged white woman who wore pearls, a Jackie O hairstyle, and flesh-colored nylons. She seemed so perfect, so waxy and plastic. She smiled and extended her hand. I didn't take it.
I'm glad you came in today, she said. Come with me so we can talk.
I followed her down the hall into a room. She closed the door, and we sat across from each other. I stared at the floor.
I know you've been having some challenges, Diane, she said.
She cleared her throat.
Can you tell me what's been happening?
To this day, I have no idea what I said to that woman. All of it was BS. I wasn't ready to talk to anyone, especially someone from my school. And the second I laid eyes on her, I'd instantly dismissed her as someone who couldn't relate to me. So 45 minutes later, I went back through the center's doors, feeling no better than I had when I entered them. What happened 12 days later still haunts me. Chapter 12. The Edge. In the broken places, the light shines through. Leonard Cohen, singer. Forecasters had predicted snow, and on the evening of December 13, 2007, it arrived. Ahead of the downfall, commuters rushed home early from work, bringing gridlocked highways to a standstill. Last-minute shoppers scurried into supermarkets to pick up bottled water. Neighbors emerged from their front doors and scattered salt on their steps, hoping to ease the next morning's shoveling duties. By nightfall, the city's hubbub had quieted to a murmur, and Boston slept under a thick blanket of white. I was tired, so I turned in early at 9, even before Brian had made it home. I was scheduled for back-to-back bartending shifts the next day and badly needed some rest. Maybe I won't have to go in because of the weather, I thought. Things seldom went that way, but I could hope. Bzzz, bzzz, bzzz. I lurched toward the alarm clock at my bedside and switched it off. 8:50 a.m. I glanced over at Brian, who must have come in after I was knocked out. I hadn't even heard him. He stirred, turned over, and looked sleepily in my direction. What are you doing today? He asked. I gotta work later, I groaned. I pulled the comforter up around my neck. Just 5 more minutes, I told myself. When I woke up again, the red digits on my clock read 9:40 a.m. Brian had showered and dressed. He popped his head in the bedroom. I have to make some stops on my way home, so I'll get in late, he told me. I'll see you when I get back. Seconds later, he was out the door. I stretched to get my phone from the nightstand. 2 voicemails. I pressed play.
Miss Guerrero, said a woman's voice, we have an urgent financial matter to discuss with you regarding your credit card account. This is our 5th and final attempt before legal action will be taken. Please return our call immediately. This is an attempt to collect a debt. Click.
The next message followed.
Diane, I'm calling you on behalf of the Regis Financial Aid Office, I heard. It's extremely important that you come by our office as soon as you can. We need to talk with you about your Stafford loan. Click.
I flung back the comforter and went into the bathroom. I turned on the faucet, leaned my head down into the sink bowl, and splashed cold water on my face. As the holidays had neared, the city buzzed with lightness and joy. I wanted so much to be a part of it, but I couldn't fully do it. Do you know what it takes for a cheery and highly optimistic person such as myself not to enjoy Christmas? A lot. So you know shit had to be unsettled. Everyone seemed so happy. Even the usual Grinches chirped hello to passersby. Salvation Army volunteers with their rosy cheeks and big grins stood out in front of Macy's and rang their bells to welcome donations. I was like Alanis Morissette in her Hand in My Pocket video, standing naked in the middle of all that Christmas cheer, although I wasn't singing or happy to be naked. I was just dull
and blah. In late November following Thanksgiving, I tried to jolt myself into the spirit by window shopping near Downtown Crossing. I came home even more depressed.
The crowds, the bright lights, the music, the families strolling gleefully along the boulevards, it all made me keenly aware of how alone I was.
I sleepwalked through my days, all of which looked exactly alike. Home. Drinking. From the time I dragged myself out of bed, I began counting the minutes until I could crawl back under the sheets. I'd lost my grip on everything important to me, and soldiering on was the best I could manage. Here and there, I'd have a halfway decent moment, a laugh, a little relief while watching TV. But then I'd watch something that made me hate my life and want to trade places with someone else. Morning turned into afternoon, and before I knew it, it was time for my evening shift. After Jasmine Sola, I'd taken a job at a nightclub. I reached the T entrance, descended the stairs, and began mentally preparing myself for the evening. I was starting to really dislike my work environment. I mean, at first, it was fun and easy money, but it also got mind-numbing and superficial. And like every job, it had its share of drama. Not to mention the sketchy dudes. Like one of the regulars who was seated at the bar stool when my shift began. "What can I get for you? The usual?" I asked, although I started mixing the gin and tonic he typically ordered. When I turned back around, he stared right at my breast. A real original asshole. "It's nasty out there, isn't it, sweetie?" he said, keeping his eyes locked on my blouse. He stood, leaned up over the bar, and motioned for me to come closer, as if he was about to tell me a secret. "How would you like someone to keep you warm tonight, baby?" he said. His breath reeked. I gave him his drink without flinching. "No thanks," I snapped, picking up the glass and slamming it down in front of him. "Will that be all, sir?" He scowled and returned to his stool.
"Merry Christmas to you too, cunt," he muttered under his breath.
I endured this sort of sexual harassment a lot. Sometimes it was from the customers. Other times it was from the manager who ran the bar or the guy who owned the restaurant. Not only did it disgust me, it was very upsetting. I was more fragile than I'd ever been, and some jerk was doing all he could to get into my fricking underwear. Most of the time I could ignore it, but on this day, the man's insult made me want to climb over the counter and strangle him.
The crazy thing is, I couldn't have even worked up the energy for that. I was over it. I was wiped when I got home. I was coming down with a cold, so on the way back to our place, I swung by a bodega and bought some Tylenol. I should call in sick tomorrow. I flopped down on the sofa, flipped on the TV, and surfed through the channels. All news was about the storm cleanup. My phone rang. I could tell by the area code that it was a Colombian number. I let it go to voicemail. A half hour later, I listened to the message. "Diane, it's your papi," he said with a cracked voice. "Please call me. No one has heard from you in so long."
"You're not in trouble. I'm not going to yell at you. Please, chibola. I just want to know that you're okay."
Beep. I hadn't talked to either of my parents in forever. They rang all the time, of course, but like with creditors, I ignored their recorded pleas. Since Mommy had relocated to Madrid, she'd emailed constantly and begged me to visit. I didn't respond. In others' view, I'm sure it seemed as if I didn't care about my mother and father. Like I enjoyed seeing them hurt. Not at all. It broke my heart to know that I was breaking theirs. And yet, the angst that surged through me whenever I heard their voices was more painful than knowing I was alienating them. When we did catch up, the conversations were stilted and awkward. Where do you begin when you haven't talked to someone in a year? How do you talk through all the moments you've missed? You really can't. And every time I put down the phone after talking with them, I felt as if my own mother and father were strangers to me. People I'd perhaps known in a former life, but whom I did not recognize anymore.
I shocked myself when I began dialing my father's number. In the voicemail, he sounded more frail than ever. I wanted to check on him.
Papi, I said.
Hola, hija. Is that you?
There was sleep in his voice. I glanced up at the clock on the living room wall. 10 p.m. Yes, it's me, I said. How are you?
I'm okay, he whispered.
It's great to hear from you. What's been happening? Nothing much, I said, which was the standard answer I gave whenever anyone probed into how I was doing. I couldn't bring myself to tell him about the train wreck my life had become, which is why I directed the spotlight back onto him. How have you been? I asked. How's the family? He sighed.
Things are the same, he told me.
One of his brothers had been robbed while riding his bike to the grocery store. The week before, he'd heard from my mother's sister that Eric had been laid off from his job. And my father, who still hadn't been able to find work in all this time, was low on money.
But don't you worry about me, he told me. I'll be okay.
When Papi said don't worry, it often meant he was down to his last $20. I had zero money, but I felt so badly for him that I offered to wire him some cash. He wouldn't hear of it.
Use it for school, he told me. That's your focus right now.
We'd been on the line for less than 5 minutes, but I was eager to hang up. I love you, Papi, I told him, trying to end the call. I love you too, he said. I miss you so much. When can you come here?
I don't know, I said. We'll see. But I'll call you later.
You promise? He said.
I promise, I said. Although we both knew the truth.
My dad might as well have been on Neptune. That's how far away he seemed. I knew he and Mommy both adored me as much as any parent can cherish a child. And yet, I felt like I didn't belong to them anymore. Like I didn't have a home. A center. A base. A foundation. A place where I was from and could go back to when things got rocky. If I had an argument with Brian, for instance, I longed to be able to go to my mother's house and talk it through with her. At 14, I'd somehow been able to stuff down much of what I was feeling. But as I got into my 20s, that decade when you're figuring out everything, the gaping hole at my life's center had become impossible to disregard. At the mention of my parents' names, I'd get all jammed up. I'd revert to the child I once was, to a girlhood that had been over far sooner than it should have been. I'd at least been able to lean on Amelia and Eva in high school and early college, but that safety net had vanished. I'd wanted so badly to prove that I could take care of myself, that I didn't need anyone, that I was a full grown-up. I clearly needed others, but by the time I admitted that to myself, I'd alienated everyone close to me. That realization added to my sorrow. School had become a joke. I was pissed at everything and everyone. My grades were in the toilet. In 3 of my 6 classes, I was on track to earn a C-. In 1 course, I was outright failing. A few of my professors encouraged me to switch from a letter grade to a pass-fail in order to keep from ruining my GPA. I'd been considering graduate school. I had my eye on law. But with such a poor academic performance, I was ruining my chances of being admitted. At times, I tried to keep up with my assignments, but because I hadn't been able to afford my books, I had to borrow them from friends for an hour or two at a time. I needed tutoring, but I didn't have the mental energy or the resources to seek it out. And when I did show up for class, I was completely fatigued. I'd either worked late the night before or had a hangover, and often both. I was up to my eyeballs in debt. By the start of my senior year, I owed almost $80,000. That may not seem like a tremendous amount to some. Many complete school with 3 times as much debt. But for me, it seemed impossible to ever repay. Once I'd taken all the federal financial aid I could get, I turned to credit cards. Within months, I maxed out a Visa card and a MasterCard, which is when the creditors' calls became relentless. I shouldn't have applied for these cards in the first place, but I had no other choice at the time. I also had the financial smarts of a 3-year-old. When Mommy and Papi were deported, I hadn't yet even been taught to drive, much less sidestep ridiculous interest rates. Brian tried to weigh in, but I shut him down. During earlier difficult periods, I'd looked to the arts. Performance had always been my salvation, an experience that buoyed me in the most treacherous waters. That anchor was gone. All through college, I had this burning desire to express myself artistically. But there weren't many outlets for that. I yearned to find my way back onto the stage, even in the most amateur production. But because of everything else that was happening, and because I'd sunk so low emotionally, I couldn't seem to find a way to do that. Melancholy can feed creativity, yet it's also capable of killing it. I said nothing about my condition to anyone. That's the thing about depression. It's not a topic for breezy, polite dinner conversation. It's easier to tell someone I have a headache or even I have cancer than it is to say, the bottom has fallen out of my life. You turn into this helpless mute, wandering aimlessly through a wilderness in search of water, with no ability to scream out that you're dying of thirst. Depression is not like sadness. It's not how you feel after cutting things off with a lover or losing a job. Those things hurt, of course. But even amid the agony, you know there'll come a moment when the heaviness lifts. Despair is different. It's the absence of hope. It's a long, flat road with no horizon in the distance. It's the path my brother once walked. My eyes shot open. In the shadows, I reached for my phone, turned it on, and held it right up to my face so the light wouldn't wake up Brian, who'd come home by then. 2:52 a.m. For the longest time, I tried to make myself nod off. I couldn't. I kept thinking about all that had happened in the previous 8 years, about the day I'd come home to find Mommy and Papi missing, about how much effort it took me to lie there and keep breathing. This shit is way too hard. I slid from beneath the covers and wedged my feet into my white slippers next to the bed. Without turning on the light, I staggered my way into the living room and creaked open the closet door. I pulled out my long black wool coat and put it on. I then tiptoed to the front door, turned the handle, and stepped out into the hall. Our building had 8 floors. Brian and I lived on the first. I walked over to the staircase that led to the rooftop and slowly climbed. When I emerged onto the terrace, the icy air stung my face. My sockless feet trembled. I zipped my coat all the way to the top and clutched my arms around my chest. Light flakes, a nearly imperceptible twinkling stardust, layered fresh snow over the gray cement. I looked out over the neighborhood, eerily silent and beautiful. I shuffled toward the building's edge and stopped when I came within a foot. No wall or barrier enclosed the landing. I lowered myself onto the ground and inched forward until my feet dangled over the side. I poked my head over the edge and stared down. A parking lot, one with only a few cars in it, was below. I visualized my body, ashen and paralyzed, lying across the gravel. Am I going to do this? I'd come close before to ending it all. Once, when Brian and I were traveling out of town together, we had a heated argument. I was so distraught that I dragged a chair up to the balcony wall and climbed atop it so I could hurl myself over.
No!
Brian shouted as he darted from the room and yanked me back. Diane, stop it! You can't do this! After he'd calmed me down, he tried to reason with me. Can you imagine how it would hurt me and your family if you took your life? He asked. You're fucking crazy if you give up. He had temporarily restored my senses because when you spiral into desolation, you're no longer rational. In fact, you already feel dead. The suicide act is a mere formality. This night wasn't like the one on the balcony. I faced a simple choice about whether to jump, and no person was there to pull me back from the brink. Am I really ready to do this? The spool of thoughts that had been running through my head for weeks started up. I'm useless. I'll never amount to anything. I'm not smart enough to get through college. How can I help Mommy and Papi when I can't even help myself? The world would be better off without me in it. I'd been telling myself that things would turn around, that tomorrow would be brighter, but it wasn't. Maybe if I was older, maybe if I'd had a template for overcoming crisis, I might have realized that things would eventually improve. That a better existence was possible on the other side of the anguish. But I didn't yet have the perspective that only years of wading through horrendous circumstances can bring. At 22, all I could see was darkness. I peered down at the lot. As I did, my left slipper fell from my foot. I tried to catch it by squeezing it between my toes, but it got away from me. As I sat contemplating the end, I wasn't scared. A peace I'd never sensed settled over me along with the snowflakes. My lids grew heavy with exhaustion. With my legs still swaying over the ledge, I lowered my upper body onto the cement and dozed off. I don't know how long I was out, but a strong wind gust awakened me. Where am I? I pushed up onto my elbows and gazed around, confused about why I was on the rooftop. Then all at once, I remembered, and my precarious position spooked me. My God, what am I doing? My stomach sank. I scooted backward and tried to get up, but as I rose, I felt disoriented and groggy. I lost my balance and almost fell over. I then slid off the ledge. My heart hammered away in my chest. I clasped the pavement with my palms and struggled to maneuver my whole body back onto the ledge. It was windy and I was weak. But with every cell in my body, with every ounce of strength I could conjure up, I hoisted myself to safety. I stumbled to the rooftop center and dropped down cross-legged. I was breathing heavily. Holy shit. Did that just happen? Hours before, I'd been desperate to take my life, but only if I could do it on my own terms. In that split second when the decision slipped out of my control, my impulse for survival jolted me from despair. A vision of Mommy and Papi doubled over in grief after hearing I was dead flooded my head. They'd endured so much heartache. They'd put it all on the line to come to this country so I'd have a chance to make something of myself. With another centimeter, with the slight turn of my wrists to the left or right, all they'd given up would have been for naught. The same deep love that can wound us beyond despair also has the power to preserve us. When we've lost all determination to continue breathing, when we have no will whatsoever to soldier forward, our care for others is the one thing that can keep us marching onward. We stay alive for one another, often with more resolve and fight than we could ever muster on our own behalf. I don't know what I thought I owed myself, but I did know I owed at least two people, my parents, more than this. They'd pay too great a price for me to discard my life so senselessly. It wasn't time for me to go. Not like this. Chapter 13. Turnabout. A person often meets his destiny on the road he took to avoid it. Jean de La Fontaine, poet. By some estimates, you and I will cross paths with as many as 80,000 people during our lifetimes. Many of the folks we'll encounter will be passing acquaintances. Others will be family, friends, and co-workers who remain in our lives for decades. If even one of those people has a lasting impact on us, we're fortunate. Lorraine was my one. I met my therapist shortly after the suicide attempt. I was still hurting myself, which is what led me to her doorstep. I did most of my cutting in private, but as I spiraled deeper into depression, that shifted. After a horrible fight with Brian, for instance, I'd pull out a blade right there in front of him and drag it across my forearm. "No, stop!" he'd scream, leaping to grab the razor from me. He was terrified. Though he had his own issues, Brian was a good person. The guy did his best to pull me from my crisis. But it's hard to help someone who won't help him or herself. Because of the state I was in, I wanted Brian to be more than a boyfriend to me. I wanted him to be my therapist, my savior, my knight who galloped in on a white horse to rescue me, the way it happens in a Disney fairy tale. That ridiculous expectation put even more weight on our fragile relationship. "You need to see someone," he'd tell me. "This shit is getting really scary." I agreed, but I sure as hell wasn't going back to that Jackie O wannabe. So one evening, when I was particularly desperate, I Googled low-cost clinics in Boston. Near the top of the results was the name of a center in my area. I called and made an appointment. The next day, I showed up at the clinic and took a spot in the waiting room. I sat down next to this young Asian dude who was glued to his BlackBerry. Across from us was this blonde girl flipping through the pages of an old Cosmo. They both looked normal and cool. I prayed the same was true of this experience. Seconds later, a Latina woman stepped out of the swinging door. She was around 5'3", probably in her mid-40s, and rocking cute skinny jeans and a fitted blazer. Ringlets of short black hair framed her round face perfectly. She had on a pair of stylish glasses. "Nice," I thought. "This might work." "I'm Lorraine," she said. Her eyes were bright, her expression warm. She seemed cordial, but not that perky Pollyanna kind of friendly that makes you want to puke. "You must be Diane," she said. I nodded, stood, and followed her back through the swinging door and down a long hall. We settled into a corner office. "So, what brings you in today?" I stared at her. The usual crap, the type I'd given the first counselor, swirled around in my head. Before I could dish it out again, I caught myself. "No point in yelling for a life preserver if you're not going to take it." I cleared my throat and sat up. "Well," I said, "things have been tough lately." I glanced down at the rows of fresh-cut marks on my brown skin. She looked too. "What's been happening, hon?" she asked. "I've been hurting myself," I told her. Before I could continue, tears tumbled from my lids and down to my shirt. It was the first time I'd heard myself say those words out loud, and as I did, the realization of how close I'd come to dying swept over me. Lorraine didn't appear to be taken aback or surprised by what I told her. In fact, she scooted closer to me. "Why do you think you cut yourself, Diane?" she asked. "I don't know," I sniffled. "I guess it feels better than all the other stuff I feel." "What other stuff is that?"
"Just everything," I said.
And right there, in a torrent of emotion, the whole ugly mess of the previous 6 years came spilling out. How frightened I'd been in the months following my parents' deportation. The stress I was under to take care of myself. The financial disaster I was in. My crazy relationship with Brian. The class ditching. The drinking. The partying. The big responsibility I felt as Mommy and Papi's only hope for returning to America.
The guilt I felt for locking out my parents when they repeatedly tried to connect with me. As I told my story, Lorraine never took her eyes off of me. She let me completely finish before she spoke.
"You know, Diane," she whispered, "what you're feeling makes so much sense."
She sat back in her chair. "When your mother and father were taken from you," she went on, "you were forced to become your own parent. That's an enormous load that no 14-year-old child should have to carry. It's time for you to put down that burden." She handed me a tissue. At the end of our meeting, she asked me, "Would you like to come back and see me?" "Sure," I said, pulling a stray tissue from my purse to wipe down my face. "That would be cool."
"You're going to be okay, Diane," she reassured me as she walked me back out to the lobby.
I'd love to tell you that our session was enough to immediately straighten things out for me, but I still had thoughts. Lorraine couldn't wave some magic wand and poof, make everything work for me. That's not how it goes for any of us. It's taken years for me to see that while Lorraine's tenderness didn't keep me off that ledge, it had much to do with why I didn't ultimately jump. She clearly cared what happened to me, and that gave me one reason to carry on. On the evening I came so close to ending my life, I crept back down the stairs, tiptoed into our dark condo, slid under the sheets next to Brian, and cried myself to sleep. I never told him what happened. I didn't initially reveal it to anyone. The episode hadn't been a plea for help, a way for me to get the world's attention by screaming, "Look here, please save me!" Rather, it was a quiet moment between God and me when I had to decide whether I would go on. Part of me wanted the pain to be over, that's how much anguish I was in, but a bigger part of me knew that if I remained strong for a little while longer, my story could have a different ending. Christmas Day was a blur. I spent it in my PJs, upset as Brian tried to do things to help, like making a cup of tea. A few days later, at the start of 2008, I dragged myself into Lorraine's office and admitted to her that I was still having thoughts about hurting myself. I also told her I'd been looking at websites that supported such behavior. The whole thing was fucking disgusting, and I was desperate. She listened and offered consolation. "I'd like for you to go on an anti-anxiety medication," she told me. "We'd still have to work through everything, but the prescription would get you stable." I refused. Given the problems I'd had with the ADD prescription, not to mention my alcohol abuse, I didn't want to take anything that I could get hooked on. I needed to detox. "That's fine," Lorraine reassured me. "So, we'll need to focus heavily on behavior changes, because I do believe that you can change, Diane." "Yeah, whatever," I thought. Even as I doubted that, I hoped that she was right. After struggling through my last semester and failing some courses, I'd had to make them up during the summer. I was disappointed that I didn't get to walk across the stage with Adrian and my other classmates. But I did have one thing to celebrate. I'd live to see my 22nd birthday. They say old habits die hard, but they're damn near impossible to break when you keep yourself intoxicated. Once school was over, I got a new nightclub gig. I'd gone there to interview for a bartending position, but the manager took one look at me and said, "Sweetie, you're my newest cocktail waitress." I soon discovered that cocktail waitress was code for skimpily dressed hussy who happens to serve cranberry and vodkas. It was the last job in the world I should have had, but it was the one way I figured I could earn fast cash every weekend. I was right on both counts. Six of us worked the 9 p.m. to 2 a.m. shift on Thursdays through Sundays. There were a couple of white college girls from New Jersey, both in the area to study fashion and PR. My girl Amir was in nursing school at the time. Others just partied for a living. I forget what the others did. My favorite was Luciana, She was a sweet girl from Brazil. She was fair-skinned and athletic and had a tiny waist and an amazing J-Lo booty. Her hair swung down past her waist. The first time I saw her, I was like, holy fuck, how on earth do you have your hair that long? Luciana's family had come to the States when she was small, but somehow she sounded like she'd grown up in the Boston section of Belo Horizonte. Her accent was this weird mix between a Brazilian one and a wicked Bostonian one, dude. She'd be like, Diane, come out to the car, as in, pack the car and have it, yad. Her dream was to become a registered nurse, and she was using the money from this job to pay for school. She was so much fun and a good friend. In fact, she was one of the people who really encouraged me to pursue acting. We were all these young women. At 22, I was the oldest in the group, trying to figure out what the hell to do with our lives. You here all weekend? Luciana asked me one Friday. We were getting dressed in the bar's green room. On one side of the space was a floor-length mirror, the sort you'd see in a dancer's studio. On the other side was a short row of lockers in which we stored our belongings. The space was so tiny that we were basically tripping over each other as we struggled to put on our outfits. Every night, I squeezed into a tight corset that pushed my boobs up to my chin. To top off the look, I wore high heels, fishnet stockings, and boy shirts that were basically underwear. Don't judge. Yep, I'm here till Sunday, I told her as I painted on a thick coat of mascara. Is Heather coming in tonight? She asked. I cracked up at the way she pronounced Heather's name. I think so, I said. We're all on tonight. The doors opened at 10, but the party really began popping at 11. The house music thumped, the customers clustered around the tables, and we girls sashayed around the smoke-filled room to take orders. Each time I shook up a concoction for a guest, I had one myself. Vodka Red Bulls were my drink of choice. That's how I maintained my energy. It's also how I kept myself from noticing how sketchy this whole scene was. Come here and sit on my lap, beautiful, some bald middle-aged white dude with a huge stomach would slur. Well, hello, handsome, I'd play along flirtatiously. Let me know if you need a second drink, okay? A large portion of the job was about being super nice to gross men who were slobbering all over my tits. Okay, they weren't all gross, and some were young and handsome, but had that Christian Bale in American Psycho look. They would say hello, but all you would hear is, "Do you want to come to my place so I can cut you up into little pieces?" Then there were the few who really were cool, and to be honest, I thanked them all. Had it not been for their ridiculous spending, I wouldn't have had a way to support myself. You could call it my first acting gig. And let me tell you, I was so convincing, I should have earned an Oscar. Certain dudes would come back night after night and request me or one of the other waitresses. They felt like we had a connection with them. Either that or they were lonely, or horny, or just wanted to party, or all three. In between pouring cocktails, we'd get up on the tables or stage and dance to entertain the crowd. If you'd asked me then whether I was having fun, the answer would have been yes. Definitely, 150%. But that's because I was so super drunk that I had no true awareness of what I felt. Even as we'd get dressed in the back, I'd already have my clear plastic water bottle filled with vodka. All of us threw back so many shots that we could hardly stand up straight by closing time. In my heart, I knew this was a terrible environment for me. I made myself forget that by numbing out. Behind the scenes, there was drama, and plenty of it. For starters, we all competed with one another for Friday and Saturday nights, the shift when you can make the most tips. Things got nasty whenever a new girl came in and tried to get a spot. Aside from that, arguments erupted over pay. Every evening, one server would stay in the back and collect all the gratuities, and then we'd split the pool at the night's end. I saw Heather stuff a wad of cash in her bra, Luciana once whispered to me. She's gypping us. After scoping out the situation for a few days, we realized the others were also pocketing a shit ton of our money. On a night when we should have left there with 800 bucks, for instance, we ended up with half of that. When Luciana confronted a couple of the girls, a fight broke out in the locker room. Like I said, Drama.
Outside of my moonlighting, I had a life, and an extremely busy one at that. In the fall of 2008, I enrolled in a one-year paralegal program at Bunker Hill Community College in Charlestown. I'd moved on from the idea of a career in diplomacy and became more interested in law. If I became an attorney, I figured